This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it's time for our Week in Review, and business is even more serious than usual this week on the coronavirus front, as Massachusetts shattered the daily record with 6,477 confirmed cases yesterday. Governor Charlie Baker asked people again to take it seriously.
The numbers that were reported yesterday indicate that we have community transmission across the Commonwealth, and it's incumbent on all of us to recognize and understand that and to do the things that we need to do to keep ourselves, our loved ones, and our coworkers as safe as we possibly can.
Beacon Hill passed police reform legislation that was silently in the work for months. The NAACP's Tanisha Sullivan says it's a good start.
This bill certainly moves us closer toward justice, closer toward equality than where we were a year from now. The bill is a win for justice.
While Sergeant Eddie Crispin of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers sounded a more cautious note.
We're in a world now where I think a lot of people are highly suspicious of police behavior, and that's fine with me. I want us to do our jobs better. But I also do not want to create a world where everybody thinks like the police are the bad guys.
Meanwhile, MBTA service cuts in the offing, a $46 billion budget to be passed on a fiscal year that started more than 4 months ago. Join our panelists to talk about all of it, starting with those coronavirus numbers. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now are panelists. We have Marcella Garcia, editorial writer for the Boston Globe, and Ed Lyons, who is a Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Ed, Marcella, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to have you both. It was serious business this week, pretty much across the board. I think we've talked about the coronavirus every week in Week in Review since the beginning of March. But this felt different still. I mean, we are headed toward numbers that are beyond anything we've seen so far. I think this over 6,000 number on Thursday, which was close to 6,000 even when you adjusted it back for some cases that were reported from pre-December 1st, really took a hold of people. Are you shaken by that, Marcella?
Absolutely. I think there's still this sort of fake sense of security, I think. I mean, obviously, we all know by now that the COVID-19 pandemic has the nature of the virus and the nature of the disease makes it pretty invisible. Like, we're not seeing death. We know that it's out there and that the virus is haunting people and it's killing people. But the lack of photographs and visualization of this death, you know, funerals are limited. We have seen some hospitalizations photos, but I don't think it's the same. And I think that has had an effect in the public in making us think that it's there, but it's not quite there. And it gives us a fake sense of security. And I mean, the numbers are incredibly grim. I totally agree with you. The 6,000 number in Massachusetts was scary. A colleague of mine in the Globe editorial board remarked this week that we're about a couple of weeks away from our COVID deaths nationally reaching the number of combat deaths during World War II, and that is very, very grim. It will be a grim milestone. But again, I think my thing right now that I'm struggling with is how do we get people to really understand those numbers and to see the suffering behind those deaths? I don't think that we haven't collectively sort of grappled with that.
Ed, let me let you build on that.
Well, I'm also upset about the numbers, but I have to remind myself that it was probably much worse in the spring, that we were testing so much less and maybe it was spreading far more, but we didn't know it. I wasn't sure that the numbers we saw in the spring really were what was happening. But now that we're testing a lot more, we have a greater ability to see what is actually happening, and it's disturbing what's happening. I just think fatigue has set in. People have gotten used to making daily trips. The roads are full of cars. There's no sense by watching the traffic. There's a pandemic going on. I'm very, very worried about it. And I think a vaccine arriving is wonderful, but I think it will just cause people to say, oh, a vaccine is coming. It's over. We don't have to worry about it. So I think we have a few more months of hell, and I'm upset about it.
I want to talk about this testing thing. So, Ed, I think what you're saying is the numbers, the daily case rates now may not be substantially different than they were in the spring, but we may know about more than we did then because we're testing more. And we are. Governor Baker has said a number of times that, you know, we're number one in the nation or one of the top in the nation in terms of states that are doing testing. But Marcella, just before Thanksgiving, we saw long lines, confusion. We're seeing sometimes waits of 5 to 7 days for test results. Are we where we should be on testing? We're months and months into this. Universities are getting it right. What are we missing on the testing front in terms of a statewide strategy that would meet our demand?
I agree that we may not be testing, or we may not be at a level of testing where it feels like it's enough. I was in Chelsea yesterday doing some reporting, and as you know, Chelsea was an early epicenter of the virus here in Massachusetts, and was hard hit by the pandemic, and it still is. And I saw a city testing site. It was right outside of a city hall, and the line was long. I stayed in the area for a couple of hours, and when I passed again, the line was still long. And so it may be just anecdotal, you're absolutely right, Tizia, and I keep hearing from people that they want to get tested and they can't. And I think it's just, it may be just perception, like Ed says, that more and more people are more aware. And you're right, like we just had Thanksgiving. A lot of people may be wanting to be tested right after Thanksgiving because they perhaps, you know, sense that they were at risk. So it's hard to tell. I mean, I would like to see testing sort of more strategy around testing, for instance, in the schools. You know, we don't really need to test the kids. We really need to test the teachers, for example, right? And like you said, the universities really got a handle on this, and they started doing very, very intense testing in their colleges and the campuses. But I agree that I think we may have to be increasing tests, but only like sort of strategically, right? Like, for example, teachers, or as we talk about opening the schools, we don't really need to test the kids as much as we need to test the adults around them, right? So I agree there may be some recalibration there needed.
Let me put the number out for listeners. Join this conversation. Were the 4,600 new cases on Wednesday, the more than 6,000 on Thursday, a wake-up call for you? How do you feel we're responding as a Commonwealth? Are we doing the right things right now? Or is there more you want to see? Should we keep businesses open because holidays are so important for the economy? Or is it time to be shut down? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Ed, I'll turn that question that I just gave to listeners to you. We are in a different place than we were in the spring. We know more now than we did then. Hospitalizations are down, thank goodness. Not as many people are dying from the virus as were with the counts that we were seeing and the cases we were seeing in the spring. But the spread is huge, and the governor is very clear that he does not intend to make any changes right now in terms of the amount that we're shut down. Yet you see Mayor Marty Walsh, and I think we've got some sound on this. We've got Mayor Marty Walsh expressing some real concern that we might have to do a shutdown. Here he is.
There were people out here yesterday protesting, upset because schools aren't open, and I hear their concern, and I want to be open too. Our hotels, for the most part, people aren't visiting. We have restaurants that people, it's only a portion of people that can go into them. There's not much more we can do other than shut everything down, and that's the last resort. And we're really asking people to, you know, it's within our own power.
We are hearing critics say it's time for the last resort. What do you think, Ed?
You know, all of Massachusetts is not the same thing as Boston. I think that, you know, in Western Mass, the problem is very, very small. In some parts of Greater Boston, the problem is enormous. Mayor Walsh will have to make different decisions than Governor Baker. Thanks to Governor Baker's early sponsorship of contact tracing, we both are able to chase down outbreaks, and we're also able to develop models explaining what kinds of activities are causing the spread. We know much more about what we can and what we can't do. It's very hard for Governor Baker to prevent these sort of indoor house gatherings that are spreading a lot of things. And we now know that, you know, it looks like, oh, we should shut things down. But shutting things down that won't stop the virus is just causing tremendous pain for no reason. So I think as we've gotten better about handling the virus, we're running up against the edge of what government can order in order to stop the virus. We've gotten to a point where it's the individual decisions that are spreading the virus. And there's not as much Governor Baker can do.
Do we know that? So there was a Boston Globe article earlier this week calling into question our contact tracing program, which we're spending almost $100 million on this year. We've seen consistently that up to 50% of the spread we can't trace through contact tracing. So do we know it's these small gatherings? Do we know that's where it's coming from? Or is that our theory because we're not able to track and trace the way we want to be?
I think we're learning something about human behavior, and all we have to have is models. And you don't have to have an endless stream of data to understand that certain kinds of activities are more risky than others or are the kinds of things people are doing at a certain point in time. We see I go running early in the morning. I see, you know, cars all around a house that doesn't have a lot of cars around it. They're having some sort of get-together. We kind of see the things that are happening. So the contact tracing may not be as effective as it once was, but I think we've learned enough to be able to decide what kinds of activities are and are not causing the problems, which ones are susceptible to government regulations, which ones are not.
I'm going to go to the phones here.
Marcella,
go ahead, then I'll go to... go ahead.
I just want to say something around that. I think Ed is correct in that we know what works and what doesn't. It really is the structure of incentives that we have put around mask wearing and you know, social distancing outside, being outside, et cetera, because we know that public shaming doesn't really work, right? There are people who rationally very much understand that wearing a mask is what you're supposed to be doing. But then again, we'll decide against it because they feel that their personal, you know, beliefs or they just don't want to do that, right? And so I think that raises the question, you know, what should we put in place? What kind of incentives? Are there better incentives out there that we should be looking at to make people change behavior? I absolutely agree with Ed that it is about personal behavior. So what else do we need to be looking at to make people comply? Because it again, we have known for a while what works to stop the spread of the virus. So it's just about, you know, asking people, I guess, the right way, if you will.
I'd like to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Miles on the line from Jamaica Plain. Miles, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling because I think that in some ways this focus on personal behavior and responsibility can often distract from some of the structural decisions that have been made by the governor and the state legislature during the pandemic. And one of them, I think kind of the elephant in the room here, is keeping certain businesses like indoor restaurants where transmission has happened open even as the surge continues right here and not finding ways to possibly pay them to shutter temporarily in the short term. I understand that without help from Congress, that is difficult, but I don't quite understand why this isn't a priority for the state right now, especially given that testing has been so much more difficult to access lately.
Thanks for that call, Miles. I want to grab one more. Let's get Jeremiah in Worcester. Jeremiah, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a registered nurse at a major medical center in Worcester, and I laugh at how much other people get tested. And nurses, and I know the attending physicians, never get tested. Everyone always just assumes we're tested all the time. I've literally never been tested at work except when I was exposed and because I demanded the test. We are never tested.
Well, that's interesting to know, Jeremiah. Thanks for the call and thanks for telling us. And I'll be thinking about you and your safety. Ed, so two things there. Businesses open that Miles was arguing shouldn't be. And Jeremiah saying, I'm a healthcare provider. I am not getting tested.
Yes, but the governor has to look at what's going to work for a whole state, right? I mean, closing the restaurants is a big deal. It would cost a lot of money to pay them to stay closed. We don't have data showing that the limited indoor dining is what's spreading all of this, and it would be tremendously painful for the people who work in restaurants to be able to not be able to go get a paycheck while all this is happening. So, and the situation is also very fluid, that the season has changed, things change. We need a lot of testing all of a sudden because of Thanksgiving. The lines that are in front of the governor's house where there's a testing station went from being super long, you know, now they're very, very short. So I do think that the situation is very fluid, and what seems like a good idea may not be the right idea, you know, 2 weeks from now when things change again. So I don't think we can rely upon sort of these heuristics about, well, this is a good idea, why don't we do this? I think it's a constantly changing situation, and then deploying resources and, you know, did you shut down? Do you bail people out? Do you do this? We have to manage it on a week-to-week basis, which is what the governor's doing.
I want to go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. Kyle in Bedford. Kyle, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, I just want to share my experience in that contact tracing has not been effective for me. I received a text message on December 1st with the phone number. I called it back, and they said that I was potentially exposed on November 13th, and that technically I should have been quarantining for the past 2 weeks. So,
Kyle, how are you feeling?
A little confused that, you know, how something like that can happen. So I think they stated that I was potentially exposed to a cluster exposure. So I'm not sure what that terminology means, but really disappointed with how it's been handled.
Kyle, thanks for that. Thanks for that call. And Marcella, I'm going to take what Kyle just said because he's back to that contact tracing question that I asked earlier. And I want to pair with it this interesting juxtaposition. So here you have somebody who should have been quarantined for 2 weeks. We're running the risk of additional exposure. We're worried about how things are going to go forward. And at the same time, we have this light also sitting there at the end of the tunnel, which is two potential vaccines, which we have every reason to believe are going to make it through the FDA and start distribution within the next week or two. 300,000 doses are supposed to come to the Commonwealth in that first tranche. You said we need to incentivize people differently. How do we support people to keep a lid on it, keep a mask on it, until we can get the vaccine and get to community health?
Well, that's the question, and I'm really intrigued by that question of incentives. But I've read a few things. You know, this may not be probably what would be needed here, but I guess in some other countries, fines for businesses that allow people without masks inside, you know, could be a part of the solution. Again, it may not be the right thing to do here in Massachusetts because perhaps all businesses are compliant or they are being they're doing a good job requiring their customers to wear face masks. I mean, it could be also for restaurants. Who knows? Again, it's just an idea that I have seen thrown out there because the incentive structure may be something that we need to look at. The question of your caller about the contact tracing program, I think that's going to be a lesson here in months to come of contact tracing and its effectiveness in this during this pandemic. I'm going to be very interested in reading about that. What were the lessons? What about the nature of this virus made contact tracing really, really hard this time? It's a trust issue. It's a, you know, he was called, you know, way after. So I wonder what are going to be the lessons learned from the contact tracing program. And in going back again to the incentives question, I think we just have to perhaps talk more about that because I don't think I think we have spent a lot of time sort of shaming people, you know, how are you going to do Thanksgiving? How are you going to drive or fly, you know, to see your family? Why are you going to do this? And pointing finger and judging people as opposed to talking about what works, right? And maybe with the vaccine coming, like you say, we may not have to go there, but even with the vaccines, right? People are talking about incentives as well. As you know, there's a lot of mistrust in communities of color with new vaccines. And so we may also have to be looking at the right incentives there. I do agree that, you know, like what Ed was saying earlier, that the vaccine may provide sort of a false sense of security too, that, oh, it's coming, I shouldn't have to worry about that much, I'm going to go to this party or whatever. But still, it's going to be a limited amount of people who are going to get it. And to the question of your caller, you know, the nurse in the hospital, he may not have been tested, but he definitely get a vaccine. And I think that's a good thing. And we should all, you know, be, I guess, relieved that healthcare workers here in Massachusetts will be, you know, front of the line.
It's a big conversation this week about a lot of serious business. Before the break, we were talking about the big numbers of new coronavirus cases, testing, contact tracing, etc. We're going to shift gears now to Beacon Hill. And this next segment, I want to focus on the police reform legislation that was passed in the State House and Senate. It is now on Governor Baker's desk. Again, serious business for the Commonwealth. Call with your thoughts on that reform. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Marcella and Ed, I just want to start with getting your reactions to the bill overall. Would you rate it disappointing, a good start, just right? Ed, why don't you kick us off?
I'm glad it happened. A lot of people, you know, risk their lives to march in favor of racial justice, and I'm glad that the legislature has produced a bill that answers that.
Marcella, what are you hearing from readers on this question? Disappointing, good start, just right, very excited?
I think it's a good first step is what I'm hearing. A lot of things were left out in terms of reform, particularly on the qualified immunity question. It's the first start, and I hope it's not the end of reform, right? But it's definitely a step in the right direction.
We had a conversation earlier this week, the day that the bill went up for a vote, with Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. She, of course, is a commentator on Week in Review on Radio Boston, but she's also been really active in the police reform movement. I really appreciated her framing here. Here she is.
We are a country of laws, and we believe that when you have laws, you need some people to enforce them. The one loophole is we don't have anyone enforcing the laws against police officers when that's required. I am really excited about the Police Officer Standards and Training Board, which will be a group of 9 people whose job it is to pay attention and make sure that the police are following the regulations and laws that have been set up for them.
So, Ed, that seems like a sound, straightforward argument. You have to have, you know, you always have to have somebody watching the watchdogs, right? Policing the police. Unions, however, have come out very hard against this bill. And the reactions range from saying it's too much too fast to reacting to specific measures like the sweeping powers of the post, the Peace Officers Standards and Training Commission that Reverend Mariama just talked about, to saying that this is just punishing the police for being the police. That was the Massachusetts Coalition of Police making that argument. But what is your reaction to the tension between what Reverend Mariama is saying and the strong pushback we are hearing from police unions this week?
Well, one of them is right and one of them is wrong. I think that, you know, the police aren't starting from a neutral position. We hear about bad behavior all the time. We hear about a scandal in Methuen where a police chief is accused of granting favors for an exorbitant salary. There are endless scandals among the state police officers. Yesterday, we learned that state police were found guilty for moving a black officer from Deval Patrick's detail because he was black. I mean, enough. I mean, I'm tired of hearing about these are just bad apples. When you see this many bad apples in the barrel, it's time for some new rules at the orchard. You know, it's just the police are so powerful. They never give an inch and they never lose. You know, it's just amazing how much power the police have and how immune they are to accountability. I support my local police a lot, and our local police chief is a Black Lives Matter guy. So I have no problem with my local police. I support the police. But yes, we must have oversight. There are too many problems, and they should not be immune from oversight. They work for us. We don't work for them.
Marcella, here is Boston Police Sergeant Eddie Crispin. He's the president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers. We also had him on the show on Tuesday. Here's how he reacted to the legislation.
The notion of things are going to remain the same and we're going to continue to do things the same way we always have, this should not exist. We have to accept change and we'll adapt and continue to do the work that we do, and hopefully we'll continue to protect society and make people feel safer in their communities.
So we have Ed saying, wait a minute, enough is enough. This is not starting from a blank slate. You have even Police Sergeant Eddie Crispin saying, of course things have to change. Of course we have to evolve. Of course some amount of legislation is going to get passed. That all seems clear. I was also struck by the fact that this legislation is not going to Governor Baker with a veto-proof margin. There were a lot of Democratic legislators on Beacon Hill who didn't support it. What do you make of that?
Well, my own legislature, I live in Hyde Park, Democratic Representative Angelo Scotia voted against it. And like you say, many of them voted against it. And I think that just reflects the incredible powerful lobby of the unions. And I think Sergeant Crispin struck the right note, because police union cannot legitimately say that everything is okay and that they oppose reform. Because if they legitimately say, okay, we are for change, we are for reform, okay, then what are the changes that you would like to see? And so we haven't really seen any of that. There's just been this knee-jerk reaction against any meaningful reform or any minimal reform. And so I think he struck the right note, Sergeant Crispin, in that, you know, they should embrace this. They should they need to understand that oversight is a baseline. Like, it's really the minimum standard that they should abide to. I mean, every other profession kind of does. Why shouldn't police officers do that?
Listeners, share your thoughts on this. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you feel that this legislation strikes the right balance? How does one encourage police officers to embrace these reforms and these changes? What else do we need to do to address the kind of systemic oppression we have here in the Commonwealth that every city, state, and town has in our American experiment? Call with your thoughts again, 800-423-8255. I want to play some more sound here. This is Representative Carlos Gonzalez, who's a Democrat from the 10th Hamden. He spoke on Beacon Hill. He helped advance this cause, working with Governor Baker with the original draft of legislation that the governor put out in June. He said the bill is, in his view, not anti-police. Here he is.
This is a bill that empowers police officers with appropriate training and guidance and support to be better in the field that they have selected to be in, and we are thankful and grateful for them for doing so.
You know, over the months when we've had Ed callers call in who are police officers, they have talked about wanting more training, for example, in dealing with mental health crises. We have heard a lot from the unions in the last week in concern about this bill. But what is in here that supports officers in being able to do their jobs better?
Well, the idea is that with proper oversight and with training, I mean, even Governor Baker has proposed different kinds of training resources, you know, de-escalation and better officer training will make them better. I think the police unions have often said that by supporting certain kinds of training that they are making police officers better. This is no different. It's just coming from a different source. Although I don't think this battle is about training. I think this battle is about power, about who has it, how it works, who is subject to it. I don't think this is about the details at all. The police are used to never being held accountable, and finally that there's an effort to do so.
Let's go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We have Andrew on the line from West Roxbury. Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I don't think it can be understated the degree to which police unions are an impediment to progress. When you look at the way that the police union representing officers in New England was one of the first major organizations to endorse Donald Trump in 2016. And compare that with the way that New England has voted both times for Donald Trump. Look at the way that the New York City police unions have endorsed Donald Trump when you look at the way that those cities voted. It's clear that these police officers, these unions, are so far out of step with the communities that they serve. And by going public like this, they're almost trying to celebrate their contrary to the communities that they serve.
Andrew, thanks for that call. Marcella, Andrew's bringing up a kind of politicization here, which we are seeing in so many kinds of public conversations. What's your reaction to what he's saying?
Well, I agree. Ultimately, is what I was saying earlier, that the powerful police unions have been an impediment to reform, and it is a longstanding, powerful, you know, they just, like Ed said, they don't want to give up power. And it really is about that. When you have years and years of building a very powerful lobby and you object to any type of reform or any change to working conditions in police officers, you get away with having all these very, you know, lucrative details, all of that, you just don't want to give it away. And I completely agree that they just were allowed to become that powerful, police unions.
Ed, you know, Andrews talked about the fact that there were a number of police unions that came out in 2016 and supported President Donald Trump, and that meant they were out of touch with their communities. But in 2016, more than 1 million people voted for President Trump here in the Commonwealth. And the numbers were quite strong in 2020 as well. How do we get in sync as a people of the Commonwealth around these questions of police reform? Can we do that?
Sure. I don't think people are claiming that police officers are all voting for Donald Trump because they like his economic policies. I think what people are saying is that they are at least comfortable with the statements that he makes about race and about power and about police authority. I think that's the worry, not that they are simply voting for the Republican. It's the fact that this is a signal of how they view the role of power in the hands of the police and for whom that is being exercised and upon whom that is being exercised. I think that is the worry. Yes, we can have a large number of people who do not believe that the police should be held accountable in this way. But if there's a much, much larger amount of people that believe the police should be regulated properly, then we can accommodate that. We don't need universal agreement on overseeing the police. And the problems we're having with getting this kind of stuff passed is not that there are X number of Trump supporters. It's the fact that the unions are incredibly powerful and they've given a lot of money and they've done a lot of favors for a lot of powerful people. And that's really the impediment here. It isn't the Donald Trump voter. It's the fact that the police are used to fighting and winning.
So, Ed, I'm actually going to stay with you for a minute longer and ask you. This now sits on Governor Baker's desk. He did issue a proposal for police reform legislation of his own over the summer. So this is an issue he's been paying attention to. But there are some things in this bill, like attention to qualified immunity, that were not in his draft. Do you think he will sign it?
Yes, it's my guess that he's been involved with it all along. He's not a do the big veto, set up a political battle in public. He's more of a work quietly behind the scenes, get support for things. My guess is he's been involved all along with this. And I kind of believe that his input has already been put into this bill that contains some things he probably wants for this manager of state police, which have had lots of problems. I think ultimately this is a governor who spoke about Black Lives Matter after the George Floyd killing, somebody who has good relations with Black activists. I think this is somebody who believes that we must address racial injustice, and he's spoken clearly about all that. He's done great on the SJC appointing people of color to our Supreme Judicial Court. I think he's going to have to follow through and sign some sort of police reform bill that is shaped something like this. I don't know if I'll sign it right away or if ask for changes, but he is going to sign something because he knows he has to move the ball forward, even if he's not comfortable.
And Marcella, if the governor does, well, let me do it this way. One, do you agree with Ed? And two, if the governor does it then make the slate of police reforms that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has committed to on the Boston level more easily in reach?
Well, that's a good question. Does Governor Baker sign it? I hope he does. I know that there's a lot of pressure, a lot of activists and a lot of people out there are calling his office to pressure into signing him. I hope he does. I honestly do not know what he's going to do, but I hope he does. And I hope activists keep up the pressure. On your second question, I do believe that Mayor Walsh, this is not obviously politically tenable for him to do because of the police union sway and the nations that he is taking and just in general, the pressure that they're going to put up. But I do believe that he's able to do some reform on his own that he just does not want to do on his own. Yes, he needs the legislature for certain things, but there are things that he already can do, but he just won't. Because again, the contract, the police union, and we're going into an election year, a mayoral election year. So this is going to be the question. What is Marty Walsh going to do? Will he unilaterally go for reform in an election year, go against the union, or does he kick the ball to the legislature and say, well, why don't you see what you can do here? Or even the city council. I mean, again, I really believe that he can do stuff on his own, but whether the legislation passes on Beacon Hill or not, I think it's a different consideration for him, perhaps less important than this is going to be a huge mayoral election year politically. It may not be politically tenable for him to do.
Listeners, we have been talking about a lot of serious business in the Commonwealth this week. We started with the coronavirus. This last segment just before the break, we were talking about the police reform legislation that was passed on Beacon Hill. Let's turn our attention now to the T. Many of you know we had MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak on Radio Boston yesterday talking about $128 million in proposed service cuts for the MBTA. There was supposed to be a vote on that proposal next Monday, the 7th. It's been postponed a week, but the public comment period is almost over, and these look real. It looks serious. What are your reactions? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Marcella, Ed, we did have Steve Poftek on yesterday. We got a lot of calls. He said those calls were consistent with what they've been hearing in public hearings, which is that people don't want the MBTA to make these service cuts. Then MassInc polling comes out just yesterday with over 70% of their respondents saying no. We don't want this. So why are we marching forward, Marcella?
Well, look, we had an editorial on this same topic, and we absolutely agree that this is not the right thing to do at this point. Understandably so, there has been a huge dip in ridership, and the MBTA is looking to adjust. But the danger here is that these service cuts are very unlikely to come back once and if, right, if and when ridership is restored. And the thing that I think, at least in the Globe, among Globe editorial board members, the thing that really, really moved us is when you look at who is writing the T right now or using MBTA services, right, is people who have to, people who absolutely have to do it. They are using it because they have to. And with the service cuts, we're even going to institute an even sort of poorer experience on them. And I think that's just unconscionable. I think it's a sort of a long-term reaction to a short-term problem that it just seems too drastic. And I wish they would listen to the public, but also experts who really believe that there are other ways. And I do think there are other ways to weather this storm, which again, we need to recognize that it's real, but service cuts, are dangerous the way I see it.
Ed, Marcella just said long-term reaction to a short-term problem. When we talked with Steve Poftek yesterday, I pointed out to him that in this MassInc polling data, more than 50% of the respondents believe that any cuts will be permanent, whether the MBTA says they are temporary or not. Steve said back to us on air yesterday, that's not true. You can scale these things back up. When riders come back, we can scale up to meet their demand. But inertia is a strong factor. Do you believe that if these, commuter rail stations, 6 of them closed, 25 bus lines cut, no commuter rail service on the weekends, ferries are gone, can you scale that stuff back up as the economy starts to grow again?
Yes. Let me point out that Steve Poftek is a good man. He cares about transit. He wants to help people. He's not doing this to hurt people. He knows a lot about transit. If he says it can be scaled back up again, I certainly believe him. we've seen stores around where I live where they have far fewer customers and they've scaled back their hours. That seems normal. If most of your customers go away, then you have to cut hours because you can't just stay open and be empty all the time. It doesn't make any sense. The MBTA can't run an endless number of buses and trains where almost nobody is on them. Yes, there are lots of parts of the system that are heavily used, especially by low-income riders who need it, but the cuts they're recommending are informed by that, by what lines are most needed, when they don't want to do these cuts, but you can't just say, oh, we're going to keep going with all these empty cars and buses. It shouldn't work that way.
So I'm going to jump in there on yet on a couple of things, because I've known Steve for years, and I agree with you that he is a good man. But starting back up major service on a line with big plant and equipment and specialized employees is not like expanding hours in a store. And I want to do one other thing. I want to play some sound for you here, because I asked him yesterday, had he sought new revenues before going to service cuts? And he said that was not what he did. Here he is.
Among public institutions at the state and local level, we benefited from $827 million in federal aid. And obviously, there's a lot of public entities that need assistance right now. So, our position is obviously we would accept any money that was available, but no, we are not formally asking.
And we have not heard from the governor that he has the appetite to raise revenue to do this. So I don't know that it's about whether people have good intentions and are good people, but whether we're putting our resources in the right place for the system and what it needs.
Well, yes, but again, if my store doesn't have any customers, raising more money from investors to keep me open might not make sense. I know that it's not the same thing as a store, but I'm using the metaphor to say that we don't actually know that people are going to come back to ride again, because people like me who work from home may never go back, and I won't get on the commuter rail line that I rode every day for years. So I do think the future is uncertain. It isn't like, oh, on April 1st, everyone will be vaccinated and we'll all go back to normal. We don't know that at all. So to say I'm not going to cut service, even though I'm not sure everyone's going to come back, would probably seem irresponsible. So I do think we have to think about that. And maybe, and if they say they can get these lines back up again, I think we should believe them. I think why wouldn't we believe them if we're not in charge of running a railroad?
Fair enough. I'm going to go to the phones and then back to Marcella. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Scott on the line from Hingham. Scott, go ahead.
Hi there. Did you know that today the MBTA's own advisory board issued a formal report saying that they think that the MBTA's plan for cutting service contains far overreaches, and that what they have done, the T has assumed the worst case scenario going forward instead of the best case scenario. And so the T's advisory board says this plan is overreaching.
Scott, thanks for that call. And again, Scott's from Hingham. I do want to point out that is one of the areas that would be affected by MBTA cuts, including the ferry. So, Marcella, that report did come out. Here's a quote from it. Quote, the advisory board's view is that risk of permanent loss of ridership, increased congestion, and other negative effects of service cuts to people and communities is too high a price to pay right now, just as a vaccine is on the horizon. End quote. That is an advisory board, but they are pushing back on the assumptions. What's your reaction to all that? Ooh, do I have Marcella? Marcella, did I lose you? Okay, I think we must have lost Marcella. We will try to get her back. That is life when we are all working remotely. If we were in person, I would have at least been able to see that we lost Marcella. So, Ed, I'm going to come back to you on this one. I mean, that is the advisory board coming back and questioning the T's numbers. That does seem like something that needs to be at least confronted and grappled with.
Agreed. And I do think there is a social justice angle to keeping the T open and not necessarily managing it like a business. I do think there are questions about equity, about accessibility, about, you know, whether or not you should have the service there before the demand comes back so people see it. I think these are very hard questions, but the T has excellent management. The control board is very, very good. The advisory board is very good. We're having a healthy debate about this, and the people that run the MBTA and Secretary Pollack and Governor Baker care about transit and about public opinion. So I think the debate is good, and I'm hoping that with some federal funding, we don't have to do some of this. But I think the problem with the MBTA, in my opinion, is that it was run like it was not a business at all. So running it a little bit more like a business, I think it's probably better for its long-term prospects, even though we don't like how it looks in the short term.
Thanks for that. Marcella, do we have you back?
Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened.
That's okay.
I was just going to say that I agree with your caller and the assessment of the board, that I do think that there may have been an overreach here. And one thing that also gets sort of lost in this discussion is that service cuts are also going to mean a reduction, perhaps most likely, in the workforce of the MBTA. And these are people who are also going to afford to lose their jobs. And so it's not just the ridership and the people and the cuts that may not come back, service that may not come back. It's also, we're also affecting the workforce. And I think that that should be also a big consideration that I don't think people are talking about enough.
The other thing that I do want to raise is there are a number of concerns about people who just don't have options other than the T. When we talked to Jared Johnson of Transit Matters on Radio Boston right after the MBTA proposed these service cuts about a month ago, one of the things he said was, quote, they know the cost of everything and the value of nothing, end quote. That was harsh criticism, but it was part of a conversation about bus riders and subway riders who need these modes of transportation for work and do not have an alternative. If the cuts go through, how do we make sure that it doesn't devastate them economically, Ed?
Well, for many years, we had a management that knew the value of everything but the cost of nothing. And people voted for the other approach for a little while, at least to some small degree. Of course, he's right that it does matter what the value is. And I don't think transit should be managed like a business. But there is a reality in terms of its finances, what it can do, how many products it can do, where the demand is. You know, it can't just be run like it's you know, a religion or something where it doesn't really care about, you know, financial matters. It really has to be run as an organization that has a lot to do and a lot of people to serve and only a certain amount of resources it can deploy. And so I approve of the way that it's managing it. I'm hoping that by getting all this out there that they'll get some help and they won't do all this, but the planning they have done will let them know where they can make cuts. And I feel bad if workers are laid off. I don't want them to be laid off. But again, what is the MBTA? Is it permanent employment and permanent service levels, no matter who uses it or how often? Or is it a service that must be responding to the economy and to how people use it? I think it has to be more of that than is of some sort of public good that happens no matter how much it costs.
All right, there is so much more we could talk about here, and we left some callers still on the line, but I do want to leave a little bit of time for hubbubs today. Those are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. They always bring us a little bit of a curiosity and joy. So, Marcella, what do you have for us?
So it's a bit of a national story, but I've been following very closely locally. The Transportation Department finally issued a rule to bring to align the rules around service animals on airplanes. And as you probably remember, we've seen countless of stories of all manner of animals on airplanes, you know, people claiming to you know, these animals to be their emotional support animals or pets. And because of a different law that airlines were going for, they sort of had to allow animals that people claim that they were emotional support animals, which in reality is there's no such a thing per the law,
okay.
Right? And so now that there's not going to be any more of that, service animals are only going to be allowed on planes, and hopefully no more snakes, peacocks, and all manner of
miniature,
you know,
horses.
Exactly. And so it was a long overdue. The state legislature had tried to do that, something about around that too. But again, it's a good news that I thought kind of flew under the radar this week.
All right. Thanks for that. Ed, briefly, what do you have for us?
Well, it was the great Christmas tree panic of 2020. I think that starting last weekend that the entire world went out to cut down a Christmas tree. I went out with my family after Thanksgiving and I looked at the people and said, Jesus Christ. And it was okay to say that since I was thinking of the Lord while trying to get a Christmas tree, but it was quite a scene. I think I moved from thinking about getting a Christmas tree to worrying about deforestation and releasing so much carbon into the air this massive plundering of Christmas trees all over Massachusetts. The Globe wrote a story about all these farms shutting down before December 1st. It's going to be like toilet paper where people are going to say, I couldn't get a tree this year. Can I order one from China? So I can't believe the panic that's going on right now with Christmas trees.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that, too, on the show on Monday. We've got Dave Morin, who's the head of the Massachusetts Christmas Tree Association. All right. That is the show. Ed Lyons and Marcella Garcia, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.